Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and pen for later in the show if you'd like to take some notes. So let's start by first looking at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From the AP, the number of people lacking health insurance dropped by more than 1 million in 2007, the first annual decline since the Bush administration took office, the Census Bureau reported last week. The poverty rate held steadily at 12.5%, not statistically different from the 12.3% registered in 2006. The median or midpoint, the household income rose slightly to $50,233. And the number of uninsured dropped to 45.7 million, down from 47 million in 2006. The numbers represent a kind of scorecard on President Bush's stewardship of the economy at the kitchen table level. However, they only go as far as the end of last year, before the current economic downturn started gathering force. Indeed, they could come to be seen as a snapshot taken at the high point of the administration's tenure. The picture is mixed. The gains that occurred last year were welcome, but unfortunately they are too little too late, said Jared Bernstein, a senior economist with the Liberal Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Quote, the median household is no better off now than they were back in 2000, despite their deep contribution to the nation's economic growth during this period, end quote. For example, after adjusting for inflation, last year's median household income of $50,233 was not significantly different from the figure for the year 2000, which was $50,557. The American workforce is baking a bigger economic pie, but the slices haven't grown at all, said Bernstein. The welcome news on health insurance coverage was tempered by the fact that private coverage continued to erode. Government programs such as Medicaid for the poor picked up the slack, resulting in the overall reduction in people without health insurance. The uninsured rate also fell to 15.3%, down from 15.8% in 2006. Quote, a lot of the fall is due to the increase in public coverage, said David Johnson, who oversees the census division that produced the statistics. The number of uninsured children also fell in 2007, after an increase in 2006 that had interrupted years of progress in getting more kids covered. But seen over a longer period of time, the health insurance numbers are not reassuring. The number of uninsured and the rate are higher today than they were at the outset of the Bush administration in 2001. That year, 39.8 million people, or 14.1%, were uninsured. The term moral hazard has been used quite a lot these days, and now in relationship to the Fed and the FDIC. Financial bailouts of lending institutions by governments, central banks, or other institutions can encourage risky lending in the future, if those that take the risks come to believe that they will not have to carry the full burden of losses. Lending institutions need to take risks by making loans, and usually the most risky loans have the potential for making the highest return. A moral hazard arises if lending institutions believe that they can make risky loans that will pay handsomely if the investment turns out well, but they will not have to fully pay for losses if the investment turns out badly. Taxpayers, depositors, and other creditors have often had to shoulder at least part of the burden of risky financial decisions made by lending institutions. Moral hazard can also occur with borrowers. Borrowers may not act prudently, in the view of the lender, when they invest or spend funds recklessly. For example, credit card companies often limit the amount borrowers can spend using their cards because without such limits, those borrowers may spend borrowed funds recklessly, leading to default. Some believe that mortgage standards became lax because of moral hazard, in which each link in the mortgage chain collected profits while believing it was passing on risk, and that this substantially contributed to the 2007-2008 subprime mortgage financial crisis. Brokers, who were not lending their own money, pushed risk onto the lenders. Lenders, who sold mortgages soon after underwriting them, pushed risks onto investors. Investment banks bought mortgages and chopped up mortgage-backed securities into slices, some riskier than others. Investors bought securities and hedged against the risk of default and prepayment, pushing those risks further along. So this is the concept of moral hazard in today's financial market. More locally, City Mortgage announced it will be shuttering its business in Des Moines. That means the company is cutting nearly 200 jobs, and many of those jobs from its home mortgage division in the metro area of Des Moines. Some while ago, I came across a quote from Thomas Jefferson, which seems to be very prominent in today's reality. I quote, "If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations will grow up around them, will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs." Quote from Thomas Jefferson, which we can think about in terms of what's going on around us today in our economy, both nationally and internationally. For you cookie lovers, cookie chain Mrs. Fields is to file bankruptcy. Cookie retailer Mrs. Fields Famous Brands said last week it plans to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection to help restructure its business, according to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The company, which licenses and franchises about 1,200 Mrs. Fields cookies and TCBY frozen yogurt locations worldwide, has begun soliciting votes from creditors for a prepackaged bankruptcy reorganization plan. Under a prepackaged plan, creditors vote on certain aspects of the plan prior to the bankruptcy filing in court. More than two-thirds of its bondholders have agreed to vote in favor of the prepackaged plan, though their support is contingent upon the company submitting its bankruptcy filing to the court by the end of August, according to the filing. The company plans to continue doing business and has also hired Blackstone Advisory Services to explore a possible sale of TCBY, the largest U.S. retailer of soft-serve frozen yogurt with live active cultures, according to the filing. Restaurant and food companies have struggled this year as higher gasoline prices and rising ingredient costs have eroded sales and profits. S&A Restaurant Corp., owner of the Bennigan's and Steak and Ale chains, filed for Chapter 7 liquidation in July, while Buffett's Holdings, Inc., the operator of Old Country Buffett and Ryan Steakhouses, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in January, saying customers had cut back on discretionary spending. There are several food retailers right now that are mall-based that are under high pressure. Food that is out of the home and food that is arguably discretionary is going to come under pressure when people don't feel that they've got that discretionary income in their wallets. Mrs. Fields said in the regulatory filing it would have been unable to make an interest payment in September. The company, with about $196 million in publicly traded debt, said it struck a deal on Wednesday of last week with its equity sponsor to modify certain financial terms and revise timelines under the terms of their investment agreement. Mrs. Fields, based in Salt Lake City, Utah, was started in 1997 by Debbie Fields, a young mother who made cookies from scratch at her first location in Palo Alto, California. The company began franchising stores in 1990, and in 2000, it gained control of TCBY, which stands for the country's best yogurt, through a $140 million cash buyout with Capricorn. The company has struggled with declining sales throughout the past year. In two separate transactions since 2007, the company sold its Pretzel Time, Pretzel Maker, and Great American Cookies brands to Nexen Brands, Inc., for more than $100 million in cash and stock. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. So continuing with today's show, we are constantly talking about ways for you to take control of your financial situation, both immediately and for the long run. At the beginning of the show, I give an important credit, as the thoughts, ideas, examples in this program are from the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors, and I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. Also mention that the show is based on an ascending educational program. There have been many points in the past that you can benefit by. You can review those at the archives at crewfm.com in Archives, Life and Debt. And we always start with the recap of last week's show. And what I was talking about was being an emotional spender. We had taken a little survey, a true and false survey, to see if we were emotional spenders. And by looking at that survey, we've discovered a few major points on how to deal with it. First, we identify where we're vulnerable. Is there some pattern in our particular emotional kind of spending, the particular type of experience that triggers your emotional spending? Maybe you spend when you feel certain emotions, or maybe you spend when you're around certain people. So we need to identify the exact moment when you are most vulnerable so you can take steps to protect yourself. And this is very important because we want to disassociate spending money from emotions, this kind of emotional triggering of our use of our precious resources. So it's important to identify first where you're vulnerable. Secondly, you need to protect yourself from temptation. One point that I highlighted was that if you are having problems with emotional spending, it's time to throw out your credit cards. We know a lot of people think we are a little extreme about this when we're talking about getting rid of credit cards, but in straight talk, many, many of us are incapable of soundly dealing with credit cards. We treat them as a savings account, and we don't really appreciate or factor in all of the downside of having a credit card in our wallet and using it. And in prior shows, we've discussed all the reasons why credit cards are not very economical or wise. So at this point, on the emotional spending issue, you just cut up your credit cards. And this may be the most important step you can make in improving your financial and your emotional well-being. Using credit cards for ordinary fun purchases is really a bad idea for pretty much everyone. It's really dangerous, and it's a constant source of temptation. And we do succumb to that temptation in moments of weakness. A good analogy for me is if you are trying to keep your weight down, you don't stock up with a household full of packaged snack foods, high sugar foods, junk foods, so you can have them available to tempt you. Same thing with credit cards. If we are emotional spenders, we do not have credit cards around. They just will be the stimulus that triggers our use. So bottom line is cut up those credit cards and throw them away. And the third point, if we're an emotional spender, is also to get a little help. When you want to make important lifetime changes, you really should have a circle of support to nurture and reaffirm those changes. If there's someone you can talk to about your emotional spending, get that person on board and start talking to them. The simple act of really describing your struggles can help put them in perspective. And of course, you may get some very useful ideas about how to solve your problem from discussing it with an intelligent, safe person. So what we're saying here is that if you are trying to fix something with money that is an emotional-based issue and you're spending emotionally, this is not a good thing because money can never fix that problem. You have to separate the two out. So you have to go ahead and have those feelings and have those feelings in an appropriate circumstances, but you don't have those feelings to trigger this expenditure of money. Just keep your money completely out of it. You separate spending money from feeling your feelings, and then those sticky emotional situations will be a lot less complicated when you take the money out of the equation. And I recommend that people go back and take the self-test from last week's show or the week before that to really understand a little bit more about themselves relative to emotional spending. And another issue we discussed last week was how to share your fun money, because we're talking about fun money. And if you have a certain amount of fun money that you need to divide, then that becomes an issue. The important thing is that you do that in a healthy, acceptable way with each other, whether it's 50-50 or however it seems to be a good way to do it. For example, if one person has more responsibilities with kids, then they may need a little bit more fun money. If one person is at home and there are things that need to be done at home, then of course a little bit more fun money may need to go to that person. But this is something you need to decide and then to keep it fairly structured so you know who is getting what percentage of the fun money. But the important thing is that once that person gets the fun money, we don't ask questions about it, about them spending it, about getting some advice on it should have been spent some other way, or justifying why that was not a good deal or why it was a good deal. So it's personal money, and we don't ask, we don't tell, and that's a policy. We don't try to put it into the must-haves category or the savings category. It's fun money, and people need to have a little bit of personal private space, and that's what their share is going to be for. So you find a process for dividing the money that feels fair, and then once that happens, you spend the money based on what your desires are, and that is what fun money is all about. And once it's there, there's no negotiating over purchases, no second-guessing your partner, and no quarreling over silly little expenditures. Fun money means let it go to the benefit, satisfaction, and fulfillment of your partner. And as we said last week, one final very important point is really to make room for having fun in life and to have some money for that. We know that life is big and you can paint whatever picture you have on the canvas of your life. It's yours, and that money for fun is yours also. And one of our goals is to enjoy life without thinking about money. And now that you've done the equation and you know how much you can spend on fun, leave some time to spend that money on fun and do it in a way that you want. You can make your life easier, a lot more enjoyable, and it will make meeting the harder situations and finances much more doable. The whole goal here is to have a plan that helps you make conscious choices about your money with no more sweeping everything into just some confused category, I gotta have it or I can't afford it. You are in the driver's seat, so it's time to decide once and for all what you really want. We have worked through our must-haves, the bare necessities, and we've worked through our wants or the fun money and our savings, and so we see what we do have, and now we know how to use those categories appropriately. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. So now the next thing we want to do is tackle debt. And that means the debt that you have on the books already, and to build your future basically by paying off your past. When you look at your personal bill history, you will see, of course, your medical bills perhaps, or mortgages, first mortgage, second mortgage, refinancing, money you borrowed in personal loans, and of course, credit card balances that you have had for years. All of these things are your debt side of your history, and perhaps one you'd like to forget about. But rather than filing for bankruptcy, what we need to do now that we have some idea of where the money to pay your bills will come from by doing the equation for looking at your must-haves or your bare necessities, 50%, that is, of your disposable monthly income. If you've got that set up, you put that in balance, and you've set aside 30% of your disposable monthly income for your wants or your fun money, and we talked about that in the last couple of shows on how to spend that. And that means now that you have 20% left over for savings, and we also talked about that. The curious point is that now we're going to look at our savings, which of course we think about for the future in our normal thinking, but we're going to switch that a little bit and take that money from savings to pay for your bills that are your debt that has been looming in the past. As Professor Warren says, your bills tell your past. They also tell your future. Every debt, every monthly payment, every dollar you owe is a claim against your future. Debts affect what you can and cannot do about your future. And when you pay off credit cards and IOUs, you open up new worlds of financial possibilities for yourself. You have more to spend, more to save, and a whole lot less to worry about. In effect, paying for yesterday is a very important investment in your future. By getting rid of the debts from the past, you'll be, first of all, buying some breathing room, and in effect, it will eventually buy you a future of financial freedom. And then with that, you can really reach your whole life dreams about your finances. But what we have to discover is a way to get out of that debt and to build that brighter future. So let's take a step back for a minute and just look at debt and how it basically has swept over America. For millions and millions of America, debt really has become a way of life. It seems normal in this country, right up there with baseball or basketball. In fact, more than 80 million Americans now owe money on a credit card. And the truth is, not just a little bit of money. The average family carries a balance now that is approximately 2 months' income of their whole family's income on their credit cards. Now, when we go back two generations or so to our grandfathers, back in that day, if you didn't pay cash, you didn't buy it. And that was pretty much the standard routine. And that was the American way of life. And that's not so long ago. Almost no one carried any debt except for, of course, the home mortgage, which was a standard kind of home mortgage, fixed rate for 30 years, and perhaps a car loan. And there were no giant credit card balances and no payday loans and no home equity loans like we have today. In fact, just about 35 years ago, the total amount of debt outstanding among all Americans was about 1/600th of what it is today, which is basically that every dollar of our generation owed today, our parents' generation owed less than 1/2 of a penny for that same dollar that we owe. The important question here is, how did we get into this hole? And what Professor Warren says is basically there's a 1-2 debt punch. Number one point is that the laws were changed in the late 70s. Just weren't any credit cards for regular middle class people back in the 70s. Of course, credit cards did exist more than 80 years ago, but not everyone had them. The laws were quite different back then. The interest rates were regulated by law, which meant that credit card companies could make only money if everyone paid them back. In other words, the companies didn't charge a lot for interest. They needed to screen their customers very carefully to be sure that they could repay. And so credit cards were not given out so quickly and freely. If we look at the history of the law, we see that in the last 25 years, the laws once limited how much interest a company could charge went away. Congress and the Supreme Court quietly actually took the reins off the credit card industry in the late 70s, freeing the way for credit card companies to essentially jack up their interest rates and their fees. And with this, the credit card companies learned something very important. They learned that they could make a lot higher profits from lending to ordinary middle-class people than they ever made from the silk tie crowd. And then, of course, the credit card companies started to fight to get into the wallets of every man, woman, and even child in America now. And the reason for this is quite simple, that if you don't pay off your balance every month, the bank can make an enormous profit. And in fact, credit card debt has become the single most profitable line of business for big banks. Banks have found that they can get away with slamming enormous over-the-limit fees, late fees, and interest fees on anyone who gets in trouble. And this is where they make the bulk of their money. And then, as Professor Warren says, came punch two. The credit card companies started jacking up their rates and sending offers to anyone with a pulse. But this also came at a time when Americans found themselves struggling just to make ends meet in the economy, with job layoffs, people losing their health insurance, medical bills have started skyrocketing, and the divorce rate has increased tremendously. And so what people did was they looked to credit cards as a temporary fix for their problems. And that's the first step in understanding the debt problem that we have. And we will continue next week to understand more of the truth about debt. And the final tip for the week, if your son or daughter has just gone off to college, make sure that they do not get credit cards. Major credit card companies try very hard to get young people involved as freshmen by giving all kinds of lures to have them sign up for a card. Often, upper-class people are hired by the credit card company to solicit underclassmen to get their cards. These cards are the seed for future problems with debt and should almost never be taken. If you don't believe this, you should take some time and watch the movie Maxed Out to open your eyes to these dangers. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life. And the music you are listening to is the tune Jazz House from the album Dark Clouds by Wicked All Stars, which is found as an open source song on magnatune.com.